The Women of the Arts and Crafts Movement by Sarah Middleton. The arts and crafts movement was a cultural phenomenon of the mid-19th and early 20th century. From 1890 to 1940, the output of innovative, beautiful and practical handcrafted design was simply astonishing, much of it produced in the Cotswolds. The movement sprang up in rejection of restraining, hypocritical Victorian values and was a force for cultural change. The collective dream was to create a society in which art and beauty were intrinsic to everyday life. If you want a golden rule that will fit everybody, this is it. Have nothing in your houses that you do not know to be useful or believe to be beautiful. William Morris. The revival of traditional skills and crafts, a newfound respect for the craftsman, and a fairer society were the pillars upon which the movement stood. Many of its protagonists moved from smog-ridden London to the idyll of rural communities in the villages all around us. The firm Morris & Company, led by William Morris, one of the most original thinkers and talents of a generation, was the beating heart of the movement, influencing countless fellow makers and inspiring collectives all over the Cotswolds and beyond. He played his part in the founding of the socialist movement, sharing his ideas through essays and lectures presented all over the country. It is likely that he would have lectured at Cheltenham Gallery and Museum, as it was known then, and his connection to the town is well documented. His legacy, and that of the movement, is one of the most important design movements this country has ever seen. The vibrancy of his decorative textiles and wallpaper designs endure in popularity alongside our respect for the breadth of Morris's achievements, a genuine concern for his fellow man and his love of nature, all of which deeply resonate in modern society. The Wilson is privileged to house one of the most significant arts and crafts collections in the country and has played an important role in telling its story since 1930. At that time, the museum's curator and librarian, D.W. Herdman, recognised the significance and local connection to these designers and began collecting pieces. In 1940, he secured Ernest Gimson's archive from his widow's effects, which forms the core of the collection you see today. In this tour of the Arts and Crafts Gallery at the Wilson, we're going to explore the female contribution to the movement, offering a new perspective and highlighting the social changes of the time. For the first time in history, women were able to contribute to arts and crafts in a meaningful way. In Victorian England, not only upper-class women, but the middle classes were encouraged to receive formal education. Higher education was more readily available from the mid-19th century, and as you will hear, many of the women we will meet on this journey studied at some of the country's most prestigious art schools. Women were allowed entry into the Royal Academy and the Slade School of Art from 1860. The network of women who worked at the heart of the English arts and crafts movement challenged the assumption that arts and crafts solely revolved around male designers. We will reveal the breadth of the imprint that women workers made in society from their precarious female standpoint. Through aesthetic, professional and intellectual contributions, touching on suffrage in Victorian England. It may be fitting, therefore, to start our journey with the founding of the Women's Guild of Arts in 1907. With May Morris as its first president and the watercolourist and etcher Mary Annie Sloane as its honorary secretary. The organisation offered women artists an alternative professional body to the Art Workers Guild, which was founded in 1884 and excluded women. Other key members included Mabel Esplin, Agnes Garrett, Mary Lowndes, Marianne Stokes, Evelyn De Morgan, Georgie Gaskin, Mary J. Newell, Ethel Everett, and Letty Graham. The guild grew to include about 60 artists of mostly middle and upper class women from professional trading and artistic families. The Women's Guild of Arts functioned as a powerful challenge to repeat suggestions that there were only a few female designers in the movement. Several women contributed their artistic and political energies into suffrage campaigns in the first wave feminist movement. Mary Lowndes established the Artists' Suffrage League in the same year as the Guild was formed, and many members joined both groups. It was at this time that there was a democratisation of arts and crafts, an opening up amongst the sexes and in class and society in general. Where the Art Workers Guild was dominated by male architects, not one single member of the Women's Guild of Arts chose to be identified as an architect. They were at the vanguard of directing artistic taste with their independently run shop and studios in arty places like Chelsea, off Oxford Street and in the Cotswolds. Suddenly, they were shaping roles in society as educators and cultural arbiters, feeding the success of the arts and crafts movement, which captivated the hearts of greater numbers of people than any other art movement in England. As you walk around the Arts and Crafts Gallery at the Wilson, you will come across the following female characters: Eve Simmons, 1884 to 1970, Phyllis Barron, 1890 to 1964, Dorothy Larcher, 1884 to 1952, Louise Powell, 1882 to 1956, Grace Barnsley, 1896 to 1975, Mae Morris, 1862 to 1938, and Felicity Ashby, 1913 to 2008. We will bring them to life through the tangible objects in this gallery and tell you about their life and times. The legacy of these women live on in the precious objects they made. Eve Simmons, 1884 to 1970. Three puppets in a glass case. As you enter the gallery, you will be amazed by the breadth of articles on display, none so eccentric as the puppets hanging in the far left-hand corner. In a glass case, hanging above a settee, are three puppets dating from the 1920s. Let me tell you a little bit more about them and why they're here. Eve, Evelyn, and William Simmons were a creative couple living in Far Oakridge, just above Stroud, at this time. Known for their commitment to the movement, they lived a quiet and highly creative life as painters, woodcarvers, embroiderers, gardeners, and puppeteers. By the 1930s, puppet shows had become an important part of their lives, much loved and well remembered in the community. Their shows, created for adults and children, were a professional venture and one of only three established puppet theatres in England at the time. Their puppet show played at the Grafton Theatre in London for 3 weeks and held special shows at the Art Workers Guild. They also performed in country houses, including the home of the Duke of Westminster, where on one occasion the audience included Winston Churchill. Eve Simmons made the costumes from scraps of the lightest material so as not to impede their movement, and her husband William carved the puppets and made the stage. It is said that William was full of gentle humour and quick to see it in the world around him, and to this end we can assume that Eve was too. Eve had studied art at the Slade under Walter Sickert, and she met there the ceramic painter Louise Lessor and her younger sister Therese. They would become lifelong friends. Louise married Walter Powell, and both couples made the move to Gloucestershire and continued their creative passions. Louise greatly inspired Eve and gave her much support and encouragement, so important among female friends. Their idyllic home in Far Oakridge was filled with Barron and Larcher fabrics. Eve worked on embroidery and silk designs by Louise Powell, and her own designs were delicate embroideries of flower and leaf forms. They led a frugal existence, but one of joy and creativity, with puppet shows and community theatre playing a central role. Both husband and wife gave freely of their time to support other artists and craftspeople. They were active and well-respected members of the arts and crafts community, exhibiting in Chipping Campden, Painswick and Cheltenham. William died aged 85, and Eve outlived him by 2 years. They were both creating right up until the end of their lives. John Gwynne described them as two of the happiest people one can ever imagine. So little money to live on, but just enough. They wanted no more. They were entirely satisfied with themselves and their friends, a fairly wide circle, mostly living locally, and they were two of the most self-sufficient people I've ever come across. Louise Powell, a collection of pottery painted by Alfred and Louise Powell and their apprentice Grace Barnsley for Wedgwood Pottery, 1920s and 30s. If you turn around, you will see another glass case on the wall opposite you. This one is filled with pottery, much of it painted by Louise Powell. Louise and her husband Alfred are best known for reviving hand painting at the Wedgwood Pottery. Although the couple pursued a career with Wedgwood and set up their studio in 1907, at 20 Red Lion Square in Bloomsbury, London, it was Louise's family connections that really got them off the ground. Louise was born to a distinguished family of French painters, many of whom decorated for Wedgwood. Both her aunt, Therese Lessor, and her father, Jules A. Lessor, worked for Wedgwood in the 1870s. Her father was also a well-known marine painter whose work had been exhibited at the Royal Academy and at the Paris Salon. By the early 1900s, Louise had firmly established herself as an accomplished needlewoman. Her and her sister, also Therese, studied embroidery and calligraphy at the Central School and were closely associated with May Morris and the Royal School of Needlework. Many of Louise's designs were worked on Morris silks. She illuminated some of William Morris's incomplete work and painted furniture for Ernest Gimson while her sister became the founder member of the London Group, decorated Wedgwood blanks, and their brother opened the Beaux Arts Gallery. Alfred and Louise Powell developed an artistic partnership that would flourish at Wedgwood Pottery, culminating in the establishment of the Atelier in Red Lion Square, which was very successful. At the turn of the 20th century, women entering professions on their own were often defined by the identity of their husband. Alfred's acknowledgement of his wife's talent and insistence that her name be recorded alongside his suggests a partnership of equals. They worked very collaboratively, often on the same pieces, and it's hard to distinguish which artist would take credit. Louise specialised in floral patterns, both bold and delicate, and you can see the level of skill in her freehand painted pottery in the cabinets before you. Once painted, the pattern cannot be altered or removed, so a certain amount of dexterity, skill, and experience is required. Her calligraphy training is very evident in all of her work. Louise and Alfred taught young women, including Grace Barnsley, daughter of Sydney, how to paint with happy thoughts, as most young men had been called up to war by now. The commitment of the Powells to happiness in labour is remarkable and can be seen in the beauty and detail of their work. They believed that happiness in the workplace produced much better quality and more creative work, a very modern idea. Women had become an integral part of the British workforce in World War I, challenging their contribution in society as never seen before. This led to partial suffrage being granted in 1918. By the mid-1920s, over 50 of their designs had been put into production. Gordon Forsyth, superintendent of the Stoke-on-Trent Schools of Art, said, "Mr. and Mrs. Powell are excellent artists and have a delightful English style. English pottery would be much poorer without their splendid contributions to the artistic side of the craft." Grace Barnsley, 1896 to 1975. Earthenware bowl painted in underglaze colours, painted by Grace Barnsley. If you look closely into the glass cabinet, you will see a pretty earthenware bowl painted with wispy indigo flowers and a wave at the rim and the base. This is a lovely piece hand-painted by Grace Barnsley. In fact, the whole of the middle shelf is lined with pieces by her hand. A typical deco-shaped teapot, cups and saucers, a bowl and a charming round teapot with a square-shaped handle. Although all quite different in style, we're in no doubt of the skill required in their painting. Emily Grace Barnsley was born in Cirencester, the daughter of Sydney Barnsley, the architect and furniture maker who set up workshops at Pimbury Park near Sapperton in 1893. It wasn't long afterwards then that Grace was born, followed by her brother Edward in 1900, and no surprise that both children turned to the arts and crafts. Grace learnt her craft at her father's knee, surrounded by creatives and painting pottery from a very young age. She was educated at Bedales School and then at the Birmingham School of Art. Through the connections of her father, she learnt her trade in the Powells pottery before becoming a freelance painter for Wedgwood. In 1934, she moved to Raynham in Kent with her husband Oscar, and they took over Upchurch Pottery, renaming it Regina Pottery, Roman for Raynham. It was a short-lived enterprise, and they closed the studio at the outbreak of World War II. It reopened in 1947 under new ownership and the name Raynham Pottery, producing ceramics until 1975. Grace benefited from the tutelage of Alfred and Louise Powell and their inspiring revival of hand-painted techniques, altruistic approach to education, and community, creating healthy working environments and greater opportunities for women. Her legacy is a catalogue of beautiful hand-painted pottery for one of the most prestigious British manufacturers there has ever been. Phyllis Barron and Dorothy Larcher. Settee designed and made by Sydney Barnsley, 1919 to 1923. The fabric that covers it was designed and printed by Phyllis Barron. Phyllis Barron and Dorothy Larcher were at the forefront of the revival in hand block printing in 1930s Britain. Beneath the puppets, you will see a striking settee designed and made by Sydney Barnsley and covered in fabric designed by Phyllis Barron. Barron and Larcher had built up a successful textiles business, first in Hampstead and then in Painswick, moving their studio out of the city and choosing this pretty village as their home. By this time, they were both in their 40s and successful life and business partners, leading the charge in block printing in the interwar years. They were radical in their approach to their craft, in their determination, work ethic, ingenuity and designs. Both of strong personalities, Baron had studied at the Slade and was a painter and self-taught block printer, educating herself through lectures, study and trial and error. Larcher had first become interested in textile design while travelling to India as a paid companion to the artist Christiana Herringham. She too had studied art, and they became partners in the 1920s through a shared passion for design. Their work was in complete contrast to what was generally being produced at the time, and their patterns are still very contemporary even today. Although they used carved blocks, printing with natural dyes onto quality materials, they also used old car tyres and combs to create unique patterns. A meeting with the arts and crafts architect Detmar Blow introduced them to a discerning clientele which included the Duke of Westminster and Coco Chanel. Indeed, their first major commission was to decorate the interior of the Duke's yacht, the Flying Cloud, with furnishings for a considerable number of berths. Purchases ranged from the Queen, Lady Alice Rentians, Lady Debenham and many others. They were well known in the village of Painswick, not only for their distinctive dress sense, wearing entirely their own designs from head to toe, but for Baron's piddle parties. Parties were not merely social occasions, but an opportunity to obtain a supply of pure male urine in order to cure their indigo designs. One of the zinc tanks still exists at Hambert's house even today. Hambert's house was a haven that they both loved, furnished comfortably with their own designs and with a beautiful garden from which they created dyes from the rare plants they tended to. They found Painswick was a luckier place than we had known because Stroud nearby had the West of England cloth mills and water especially good for dyeing madder, though they themselves used German red. Baron was a member of the Gloucestershire Guild of Craftsmen from 1933, becoming chairman from 1958 to 64. From 1937 to 2013, the Guild held its annual show in Painswick. They were a remarkable couple who saw great success until the war threatened everything. Both Baron and Larcher made a big impact on textile design. Phyllis Baron was a leading figure in the community, volunteering on various boards and councils, working as an educator and an advisor. May Morris, 1862 to 1938. The Wilson holds a number of items in its archive relating to May Morris, daughter of William Morris, a central figure in the arts and crafts movement. She features in photographs with George Bernard Shaw, a handwritten postcard inserted into a copy of the Socialist League, and introduces her father's work in a book of his collected works from the Emery Walker Library. Over the years, the gallery has curated significant exhibitions about May Morris as an important figure in the arts and crafts movement. May was an impressive woman, empowered and open-minded like her mother and a skilled embroiderer, often overshadowed by the work of her father. She learnt the craft from Jane and her aunt Bessie, and at age 16 she enrolled in the National Art Training School, precursor to the Royal College of Art. She was part of the first generation to study fine crafts in art schools. By the time she was 23, she was the director of the embroidery department at Morris & Co., her father's company, which had not long been launched. In that role of great responsibility, she produced a range of original designs, many of which would have been misattributed to her father, such as Honeysuckle and Horn Poppy, which joined the firm's stock designs. She supervised the production of altar cloths, portieres, fire screens and bed covers commissioned by clients, all in the Morris House style. She ran the department until her father's death in 1869, when she moved into an advisory role. Alongside this position, she taught embroidery at the Central School of Art as head of the embroidery department from 1899 until 1905, and also taught at Birmingham, Leicester and Hammersmith Art School. May was already a divorcee, aged 45, by the time she founded the Women's Guild of Arts in 1907. Her aim was to keep to the highest level of the arts by which and for which we live, and to create a mutually sustaining atmosphere of camaraderie through meetings and exhibitions. She had been married to Henry Sparling secretary of the Socialist League for 8 years. Her position as a divorcee would have been quite radical at the time, even for an independent woman of means like Mae Morris. She was instrumental in shaping the Art Workers Guild in its early years and using it as a basis to support the founding of the Women's Guild of Arts in 1907, with Morris as its first president. From the beginning, Mae was striving for all the benefits afforded to their male counterparts, even simple things such as access to the use of halls at Clifford's Inn and Queen Square, prestigious sites of masculine empowerment. Being allowed access was seen as a tremendous step forward. Her commitment and passion in her craft kept her busy and well connected. She was very active at the Royal School of Art Needlework, where her Aunt Bessie was chief technical instructor from 1880. Her contribution to art needlework, freeform needlework, or painting with thread was significant. As a designer maker, Mae Morris also regularly took part in arts and crafts exhibitions from 1888 onwards. Her legacy is seen in the many examples of embroidery, jewellery, and also in the editing of her father's collected works in 24 volumes for Longmans, Green and Company, published from 1910 to 15. Mae Morris lived at Kelmscott Manor with her companion of 22 years, Mary Lobb, a land volunteer from the village, until her death in 1938. Felicity Ashby, 1913 to 2008. Printed fabric, 1950s. Daughter of C.R. Ashby, arguably one of the most important figures of the arts and crafts movement, Felicity Ashby carved out a rich and creative life of her own. Dying at the age of 95, she is seen as the last direct link to the inner circle of the arts and crafts movement. The Wilson Gallery is lucky enough to exhibit a piece of vibrant printed fabric designed by the artist in the 1950s. One of four sisters, all of which chose creative paths, Felicity is seen as a bohemian figure with an unconventional streak. It is interesting to note that her parents, although intellectually matched, were not intimate. Soon after their betrothal, Ashby shared his homosexuality with his new wife, Janet Forbes, and his desire for a son. Undaunted, she went ahead with the marriage and produced four daughters, Mary, Helen, Prue, and Felicity. You will see works, particularly those in silver, by Charles Ashby in this gallery, and you can read about the establishment of the Guild of Handicraft Workers in 1902 in Chipping Campden. Essentially, Ashby moved dozens of jewellers, metalworkers and fine craftsmen from the East End of London to a disused silk mill in North Gloucestershire in an attempt to create an arts and crafts Eden. It was an honourable idea, but ultimately doomed. The guild soon ran out of cash and taste changed before it wound up in 1907. After Ashby's appointment as civic advisor to the British Mandate Government of Palestine in 1918, the family spent 4 years in the Middle East living a totally different life. Upon their return to London, Felicity studied at the Byam Shaw School of Art. A highly accomplished all-round artist, she excelled in wood engraving and textile design. In the 1930s, she joined the Communist Party, determined to help the anti-Franco struggle in Spain. Soon after, she joined the WAAF to fight another of Europe's fascist dictators. Posted to Bletchley Park, Ashby found that her communist background was hampering her promotion with the intelligence corps. After the war, Ashby resumed her artistic career and taught at girls' schools in Hertfordshire and London. By the 1950s, she was living in a small flat on the Edgware Road, working as a book illustrator, portraitist, and textile designer. After retirement, Ashby continued to pursue the interests of her youth: peace, freedom of expression, creativity. And in 2002, her acclaimed memoir, Janet Ashby, Love, Marriage and the Arts and Crafts Movement, was published.